Well, good morning, everybody. And thank you, Kristen and Amanda. That was great. Let's hear it up for them. They did a great job honoring mothers this morning. Fantastic. And I just want to pay a tribute to every mother in this room, and I hope that you take some special time to pay tribute to your mother today. Even though my mother's not here, I'd like to pay tribute to her. It's been 17 years since my mom left the planet for heaven. I think about her and my dad every single day. There's not a day that goes by I don't think about them. And I appreciate the legacy of my mom in my life and in my siblings' lives. And though it's been 17 years, the words that come to my mind when I think about my mom are the words that are really her epitaph that we put on her tombstone when she died. And the words are, loved well. And if you knew my mom, you knew that she was a woman who loved well. Taught us a lot about how to love selflessly and give yourself away continually. So in keeping with our series, Generous Love, and today the message is about loving my family, I'd like us to think a little more deep about what loving our family looks like, because we know the members of our family better than anybody else, and they know us better than anybody else knows us. We know their flaws and weaknesses, they know ours, and typically we have things about our family members that we respect and appreciate, as well as things that really bother us about them, as well as things that really sometimes anger us. But because we know each other so well, we know things about each other and have been hurt by each other in ways that we probably haven't by other people. In fact, I think it's fair to say that it's very likely that some of our greatest disappointments and our deepest wounds have come from a family member, from a mother or a father, or a son or a daughter, or a brother or a sister, or an aunt or an uncle, or a grandparent or a cousin, or from a husband or from a wife. And it's very likely that the people in our family have been hurt the most by us as well. I wish that I could have a nice, warm, fuzzy message for Mother's Day, but I felt that an honest and a realistic message would be a whole lot more helpful in the long run. So let's begin by normalizing the fact that every family has conflict and problems. Every single family is dysfunctional. Sometimes you'll hear people say, well, that family's real dysfunctional. Well, every family's dysfunctional. Or as I often say, every family's sin-functional, because every member of every family is fallen and has a sin nature and therefore does and says things that hurt each other and wound each other. And our expectations are often higher with family members than they are with others. Therefore, the disappointment is greater and the wounds go deeper. So let's normalize the fact that every family's messed up, including ours. And let's not think that our family or your family is somehow so different and so messed up that you're in a whole different league. It's not true. Every family has issues. And so let's start by admitting that, and let's admit that we need help. Every family needs help. We need God's help because He calls us to love generously. He calls us to love the way He loves us, and there's no way we can do that by ourselves. We need supernatural help. We need God to intervene and enable us to love the way that He has loved us. So I'd like us to take a look at a family in the Bible who, though clearly called by God, was messed up. And I'd like to bring your attention to the fact that God doesn't cover up their junk. In fact, He actually has it written about in His book that we call the Bible. And so, God is an honest God, and He writes about these honest realities in this family in His book that we're going to look at. So, when I was preparing for this, I thought, what if God was still writing His book? What if the Bible was still being written, and your family got written about in the Bible? And God was honest about your family and the issues in your family, like He was the family we're going to talk about, because we're not a whole lot different. So let's dive in. Let me introduce you to the this couple when they first got married. Their names are Isaac and Rebecca. Abraham's son, Isaac. Abraham's getting old, and he wants a son for his wife. No, he wants a wife for his son. Amanda. Where's Amanda? And so Abraham sends his servant to go look for a wife for Isaac. And the servant prays. And the servant says, God, direct me and lead me to just the right woman for him. And so the Spirit of God actually leads this servant and has some fleeces and some signs, and it becomes clear. And Rebecca is this chosen woman, gets permission from her family, and the servant brings her back and brings her back to Isaac, and they see each other and they greet and they marry, and this marriage is off to a wonderful start. They loved each other very deeply. Now, the first problem that they faced was barrenness. Rebecca wanted children, and so did Isaac, but they were unable to have children. And so Isaac prayed, and Rebecca conceived and was pregnant with twins. Well, Isaac didn't just pray. I mean, he prayed, but God answered his prayer. Some of you will have to ask someone after the service what I was talking about. That's okay. All right, so Rebecca gets pregnant and gives birth to twins. The first one to come out, his name is Esau, and the second one's name is Jacob, older and younger. And that's where we step into the story in Genesis 25, 27. It says, when the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the field. But Jacob was a peaceful man living in tents. Now, remember, Esau is this rugged outdoorsman type who likes to hunt and probably likes to fish. It doesn't say that, but they live by water, so probably like to fish. And Jacob is more the indoors kind of guy. He's more domestic and peaceful. Now, just from that little bit of description between the two of them, which one are you inclined to lean toward? Which one do you think, gosh, you could probably get along better with that one than the other one? Well, I mean, from what you know of me, which one do you think I'd probably click with more? Probably. Jacob, you're right. So, look at what happens here in the text. Genesis 25, 28, it says, now Isaac loved Esau because he had a taste for game, but Rebecca loved Jacob. You know what that's called? That's called favoritism. It's called favoring one child over the other child. And in this case, the dad favored Esau and mom favored Jacob. And the reason that dad favored Esau is because he had a taste for game, because he was an outdoorsman, because he was a hunter. And it's so easy to do. And Rebecca favored Jacob because he was more domestic and helpful around the house. A father can favor the son or daughter who likes what he likes. A father that likes to hunt and fish and golf favors the son or daughter who likes to hunt and fish and golf and neglects the one who doesn't. A mother may favor a son or daughter who's more domestic and helpful, helps with the other kids, and or favor the child who's more compliant and does what they're told. There's many different reasons for favoritism, but it exists in so many families, and it did in this one. Favoritism is a reward for the child being what the parent wants. Favoritism is never for the child. Favoritism is always for the parent. It's meeting some kind of a need inside the parent. Favoritism not only harms the child who's not favored, favoritism harms the child that is favored as well. Favoritism forms allegiances between the parent and the favored one and a wall between the one that is not favored. Favoritism from a parent automatically causes rivalry between the siblings because they're fighting for attention and affection and favor. And so there's a competition that automatically is bred. In this case, there's double favoritism because dad's favoring one, mom's favoring the other, and it causes a dualism in the competition between those two brothers. So let's fast forward this story a little bit, and let's get to the point in this story when Isaac is older. And Genesis chapter 27 tells the story. It says that Isaac is old and his eyesight was getting bad. And he called Esau to his side. And he said to Esau, listen, I want you to go out in the field and I want you to hunt. I want you to kill some game and I want you to bring it back and prepare it. And then I want you to bring it into my room. And I want us to have a meal together, just you and me, father and son. Some real bonding time together. And then after we have this nice venison meal together, I'd like to give you the blessing, the birthright that's promised to the oldest son. So Isaac sends him out, and Esau is all excited about this moment that he gets to spend with his dad. And apparently, Esau selling his birthright to his younger brother Jacob when they were younger for a bowl of soup didn't have any legal or binding bearing because Isaac is still very intent on giving the birthright to the oldest son and the blessing to the firstborn. So in Genesis 27, verse 5 and 6, it says, Rebekah was listening while Isaac spoke to his son Esau. So when Esau went to the field to hunt for game to bring home, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, Jacob, behold, I heard your father speak to your brother Esau, saying, and then she goes on to explain what she heard Esau or Isaac say to Esau. Now, I would call that an invasion of privacy. Rebekah listening in. If you read a personal email or a personal letter or listen in onto a personal phone call of a family member that you're not invited into, that's an invasion of privacy. And that's what Rebekah did. And she's listening, and then she runs right away to her son Jacob to tell him. Now, right after the two boys were born, not long into the story, there's clear favoritism. And now, near the end of Isaac's life, the favoritism is as strong as ever. It's in full force. So Rebekah calls Jacob in, tells him what she heard Isaac tell Esau, and then gives him some instruction and says, listen, I want you to go out to the flocks and take a couple goats and kill them and bring them in. And I'm going to prepare the meat and bring the meat into your father. And Jacob questions it. He's like, something doesn't feel right about this. Why, Mom? What's going on here? And he questions it. And in response to his questioning, her instructions, look at, she says to him in chapter 27, verse 17. It says, but his mother said to him, your curse be on me, my son. Only obey my voice and go get them for me. If you get in trouble by what you're doing, I'll take the curse. I'll take the blame, but you do what you're told. Do you understand? Folks, do you understand how hard it is for a favored child to say no to a parent who is favoring them? They intuitively know that if I don't go along with what my parent wants me to do, the favoring parent, I don't comply, I'm jeopardizing that favor. And I could get on the outside with them. I could be rejected, and they withdraw their favor toward me. It's risky. So Jacob does as he's told. And Rebekah took some of Esau's garments and put them on Jacob, two skins of goat on his hands and on the smooth part of his neck, so that when the father would touch him, it would feel like Esau, because he was hairy and Jacob wasn't. That's a whole other subject about being hairy or non-hairy, but we won't get into that. But Jacob goes along with it, goes and kills these goats, and she has this whole scheme, and Jacob senses something's wrong. And he kept asking questions, but his mom kept saying, putting pressure on him to go along with it. And then Jacob goes in and starts talking to his dad, and now he's perpetuating the lie to his father. At one point, while Jacob's in there pretending to be Esau, and listen, Isaac knows something's not right. And if you read the text, there's several times he asks questions like, how come this? How come this? What's going on here? And at one point, Isaac asked him, how did you get in here so quickly, Esau? It wasn't that long ago I told you. How did you go out, kill an animal, field dress it, cut it up, bring it back, prepare the meat? And how'd you do that so quickly? Now look at the answer to this. When he asked, he thought he was asking Esau, but he's actually asking Jacob. Look at the response that Jacob gives in chapter 27, verse 20. Isaac said to his son, how is it that you have it so quickly, my son? And he said, because the Lord your God caused it to happen to me. Wow. Folks, you understand it's one thing to lie. It's even worse when you use spirituality to strengthen your lying cause. When you bring God into it or God talk, it's harder to refute. And that's why some people use God or use God talk or spirituality when talking to someone else to manipulate them, because it's harder to refute what they're doing when you say God's in it. And that it brings a much more level of seriousness to it. Sometimes when people do this, they bring God into something. I just want to say, leave God out of it. Just admit this is what you want and this is what you're doing. Don't bring God into it. Or continue on in your lie, but don't use spirituality to try to enforce your case as greater leverage. Well, Jacob learned well how to deceive at the feet of his mother. And Rebecca coached him and trained him how to lie to get what she wanted. And then Jacob learned how to lie and deceive to get what he wanted. And Jacob is rightly named. His name means deceiver, means supplanter. So Jacob walks out from getting the blessing deceitfully from Isaac, because Isaac just eventually is convinced that this is really Esau, and he walks out from getting the blessing, and it wasn't much longer later that Esau comes back from the field, and he brings his wild game that he'd prepared into his dad. And so he walks in, and Isaac, you know, says, who are you, my son? And Esau says, Esau, you're firstborn. And in that moment, Isaac realizes that he's been deceived and lied to and duped by his wife and his youngest son. And how did he respond when he realized that he'd been deceived? Well, Genesis 27:33 says, and Isaac trembled violently. I try to imagine that moment when it dawned on him that he'd been tricked and lied to. It says he trembled violently. I'm just picturing his whole body like shaking because he's so affected by what he's realizing had just taken place. Violently trembled. How devastating it is to realize that someone that you knew and were close to and trusted and your own family member lied to you and deceived you. That hurt goes so deep. And that's how Isaac felt. How did Esau feel? Imagine that moment for Esau when he finds that out. It tells us Genesis 27:34, when Esau heard the words of his father, he cried out with an exceeding great and bitter cry. And he said to his father, bless me, even me also, O my father. He cried out with a great and bitter cry. So would you if in that moment you realized that you'd been taken, you'd been shamed, you'd been lied to by your mom and your brother. And now you're without the blessing. And in that moment, he just cried. So would we. Perhaps you've been lied to or deceived by a family member, or something was done and it was all hidden from you. It was all going on and you knew nothing about it, a scheme, a plan, and you were left in the dark. Or a sibling somehow got more of the inheritance than you did, or something was unfair or deceitful, or one of your parents or both of your parents spends more time with your sibling and gives them more attention than you. Or maybe they take your sibling's children and spend a whole lot more time with your siblings' grandchildren or their grandchildren than with your kids, and it doesn't feel fair, or there's something similar, and things like this hurt. They wound. It affects everybody in the family. Might I also say that lying destroys trust? And when there's not trust in a relationship, that relationship begins to deteriorate, because without trust, there's no building of a relationship. And lying and deception destroys trust, and without trust destroys relationship almost more than anything. And so in Genesis 27:35, it says, "And he said," Isaac said to Esau, "your brother came deceitfully and has taken away your blessing." Isaac named it. He explained the deceit. He called it what it was. Some families don't name the sin. They dance around it. They have a no-talk rule. Everybody knows what's going on in the family, but nobody brings it up. Everybody's afraid to bring it up because they know what's going to happen if they even mention it. You can't bring up things like that, so everybody pretends and everybody avoids and covers it up or is silent. Nobody talks about it because everybody's afraid. But Isaac talks and he names it. Now, let me just insert here too that we know that God had prophesied that the older would serve the younger. And so we knew that was God's plan. But this is not the way that plan was meant to unfold. So just because God wanted it to happen doesn't mean the way that it happened was right. It was wrong. It was lying and deceit. God had a different way that it was going to work out that we don't know, because God didn't have the opportunity to do it the way he planned, because people stepped in and manipulated. So in Genesis 27:38, Esau said to his father, "Dad, do you only have one blessing, my father? Bless me, even me also, O my father." So Esau lifted his voice and wept. When he realized that the father had given the blessing, the birthright, to the younger son, he knew that was not retractable, because a vow is a vow. And when you make a vow, you keep a vow, and you can't reverse it. And he knew that. So then he said, "Okay, it hurts. I accept it. But do you only have one blessing, Dad? Do you have another blessing? Is there any way?" And then it says he lifted his voice and wept. Folks, when we've been lied to and deceived or taken advantage of, or we've been neglected or forgotten or rejected or wounded in some way by a family member, it's grievous. It hurts. And there's a time to simply lift your voice and weep, to grieve, to cry, because it hurts. It's very appropriate what Esau is doing in grieving over the realization of the loss of something that he thought was intended for him. But once you acknowledge the offense and acknowledge the wound, and you weep and grieve appropriately, what do you do next? What you do next determines the course of the rest of your life. Once you acknowledge the offense and the wound, and you weep and grieve, do you turn to God? Do you pray? Do you trust him? Do you say, "God, I need you to walk through this with me. I need your strength. I need your wisdom." Do you say, "God, even though I wish this wouldn't happen and it hurts horribly, I trust that you're bigger than what happened, and I believe that you can use this for good, and I believe that you're God enough and good enough to somehow step into this and turn it around somehow for good. I trust you with what happened that I can't do anything about." Or do you get bitter? Do you hold a grudge? Do you get resentful and revengeful? Well, how did Esau respond? Look at verse 41. So Esau bore a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, "The days of mourning for my father are near. Then I will kill my brother Jacob." The days of my Father's mourning are near, meaning my dad's close to death. I'm not going to kill my brother while he's still alive. He at least had enough respect for his father to do that. But he said, once my dad dies, I'm going to kill my brother. And he was on a mission to destroy his brother's life, to kill him. So now Esau isn't just hurt and angry. He's bitter and resentful and revengeful. And when we are bitter, we typically want to do something to harm or kill the other person. Either kill the relationship, kill them emotionally, kill their reputation, do something to harm them, to get even with them. Because of how they hurt us, we're going to hurt them back. And now Esau is in a revenge mode. Hebrews 12:15 talks about a root of bitterness springs up and it defiles many. It defiles you, but it defiles many around you too. When you let bitterness take root, it springs up and it takes over. And that's what's happening in Esau's life. Bitterness is taking over. So when this happens, Rebekah steps in again to advise her son Jacob. And do you know what kind of advice she gave? You know what would have been ideal at this moment for Rebekah to say, okay, let's stop. Jacob, listen, I counseled you wrong. I gave you bad advice as a mom. I helped you deceive and lie to your father and your brother. We didn't trust God with that. We took it in our own hands. I'm sorry. I want to ask Isaac and Esau to forgive me. And I encourage you to do the same because you went along with it and you got your part too. So let's go and repent and ask for forgiveness. But that's not the advice she gave. Look at the advice she gave in Genesis 27:43. He said, now therefore, my son, Jacob, obey my voice and arise and flee to Haran, to my brother Laban. Stay there with him a few days until your brother's fury subsides. Until your brother's anger against you subsides and he will forget, and he forgets what you did to him. Then I will send and get you from there. Why should I, thinking about herself, be bereaved of you both in one day? I'm already separated from Esau because he figured out I was part of this, but I can't bear the thought of being separated from you. So run and hide, avoid, don't face the music, hide with my brother Laban for a few days. So unrealistic. Does she really think that in a couple days Esau's going to forget about this? He's already in the rage and revenge mode. But she is so unrealistic. She thinks a few days he's going to forget about it. Then she'll send word and Jacob will come back and everything will be happy and they'll have a nice, wonderful ending to their life. It's not how it happened. You know what happens? Best we can tell, she never saw Jacob again. Because there's consequences for deceit and lying. And the very thing she wanted the most, she ended up losing because of the way she did it. Rebekah gives horrible advice to Jacob to tell him to run and avoid and flee. Listen, when there's conflicts and problems and you sinned against a family member, don't avoid it. Don't run. Don't run to go stay with an uncle. Address it. Address it and own what's yours. So now the whole family's alienated. I mean, Jacob and Esau are alienated as brothers. Jacob's running for his life because he knows Esau wants to kill him. Esau's on the run, so the two sons are gone. Mom and dad have no contact with them. They don't have cell phones. They can't text. They don't have Skype. Seriously. And the best we can tell, Jacob and Rebekah never saw either one of their sons again. What a sad ending. And so now who's left is Isaac and Rebekah. And what kind of conversations did they have? Because prior, Isaac's life is wrapped up in favoring his son Esau, and Rebekah's life's wrapped up favoring Jacob, and now neither one has either one. And now it's just the two of them. I wonder what they talked about. We don't know. Sometimes I wish the Bible would give us a little more information. You know, like did Isaac say, hey, can we talk about what you did? Can we talk about how you coached Jacob? Why'd you do that? I would like to think Isaac brought it up. I'd like to think they worked it out between the two of them, even though they were still alienated from their kids. Folks, some of you know the heartache of being separated from your children. And my heart goes out to you. They've written you off. There's no contact. Some of you know the heartache of being separated from your parents. Some of you know the heartache of being separated from a brother or a sister or a sibling. There's no contact. They don't want nothing to do with you. They've blocked you. You know what that feels like. Some of you as parents know the heartache of watching your children not get along with each other or be alienated or fight with each other, and it breaks your heart to watch them fight and to be at odds. Now, what's beautiful in this story is it has a great ending, because I don't know if you realize, but Esau and Jacob reconciled. It took a long time for that to happen, but it happened. And in Genesis 32, it tells us that Jacob had a plan, and he was going to put all of his servants and then his concubines and their children, his children from them, and then Leah and her kids, and then Rachel and her one son at the time, Joseph, and then him. He was going to go last, which is a real cowardly thing to do. Like, he knows it's time to go meet up with his brother and reconcile, but he's scared to death. So he sends servants to Esau to go kind of feel out the land, and they came back and said, Esau wants to meet you. In fact, he's coming, and he's got 400 men with him. And Jacob paralyzes. He's like, oh, gosh. And he's scared. He's deathly afraid. But what I want to point out is what's beautiful here is that Jacob is the one that took initiative here. He was the one that originally offended, and Esau was the original one that was offended. Most often when there's relational conflicts, the person who's been offended goes to the person who offended and said, you offended me. And okay, there's a time for that. Matthew 18:15 says, if a brother sins, go to him and address it. There's a time to do that with a right heart. But in this case, the one offended initially took initiative to go to the one he offended, which is ideally the way it should happen. When someone offends someone else, they should take initiative to go to them and not wait for them to come and confront. And so good for Jacob, even though it was a long time. It was probably up to 20 years. But finally, he knows he has to deal with this. So he sends out the servants. They come back, give him this news. He's scared. And so something happens between the time he knows he has to go to Esau and the servants come back with the news that 400 men are coming and he's scared, to the time that they actually met up with Esau. You know what it was? It's an encounter that we're familiar with called Jabbok. When they had to cross this ford and he sent everybody on ahead of him and he was the last one to cross. And then God showed up. Remember, an angel of the Lord showed up and wrestled with Jacob all night long? That was right in the middle of this story. Do you understand what's happening here? Jacob wrestles with that angel, which I believe is the pre-incarnate Christ, all night long. And then finally, after wrestling all night long, he surrendered and he gave up and he walked with a limp from that time on. His walk with God was different. Do you understand that the turmoil and fear of knowing that he was going to have to face Esau after all those years drove Jacob to a new place with God and forced him to wrestle with God about it? Because ultimately, our battles, even our relational battles with family members, has more to do with what's in our heart between us and God than it does between us and that person. And so Jacob is alone with God, and God's trying to get at something very deep inside of Jacob's heart. And God uses unresolved relational issues with family members and others to drive us to a deeper place of dependence upon him. And Jacob wrestled with God and got to a whole new level, and his walk was different after that encounter. And I believe his heart was different, so that when he did see Esau, his heart was really in a good place because he'd been with God. Don't try to reconcile with a family member that's really messy unless you've spent time at Jabbok, unless you've spent time with God making sure that God's got your heart before you go talk to them. What a beautiful timing in this story. God has his ways of getting our hearts ready for reconciliation and relationship. So Genesis 33, 3 and 4, it says, but he, so now he had this time with God. Now he's resuming to go meet with his brother Esau. And it says, but he himself passed on ahead of them. In other words, he had everybody out in front because he was scared. But because of an encounter with God, he gained the courage to face his brother. He had no idea what Esau was going to do. So he ran out in front of everybody as a courageous person should do. I'm going to face him face to face. I'm not going to hide behind anybody else. And he runs out and ahead of them and he bowed down to the ground 7 times, which is a beautiful sign of humility and brokenness. And 7 times is a number of completeness. Until he came near to his brother. And then Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and he kissed him and they wept. Oh, how sweet it is when reconciliation happens. When there's a restoration, when there's been a division and schism and there's a healing, there's nothing more beautiful. There's nothing that brings satisfaction and joy to the heart of God than when brothers and sisters dwell together in unity, when they work through the issues and they forgive. What a moment. What a moment. Now, it didn't happen quickly. Again, it was probably 20 years. God had been working in Jacob's life to get him in the point that he wanted to go in the first place and then worked in his heart at Jabbok. And obviously, God had been at work in Esau's heart too. Because for all Jacob knew, he was still angry and bitter and wanted revenge and was going to kill him. But he saw him and he ran to him and he fell on his neck and he kissed him and they wept. Folks, for true healing to occur, it will require repentance from you for your part and a willingness to extend forgiveness to the other who has offended or wounded you. Let me say that again. For true healing to occur or reconciliation, it will require repentance from you for your part and a willingness to extend forgiveness to the other who has offended or wounded you. Let me wrap this up. Some lessons from this incredible story. Number one, realize that every family has issues. Normalize that every family struggles, okay? You're not weird. You're just a family that struggles like everybody else. Number two, name the specific conflict or issues in your family. Name them and begin a conversation about them. Number three, assess the effects of the damage done. The things that you've done that have hurt the family members, the things others have done in the family that hurt, just start to talk about them. Not in a condemning, going to crucify you kind of a way, but just begin a conversation. Number four, address your own issues first before you address other family members' issues. You go first in owning what's yours. That's what Jacob did. He went with the intent of saying, hey, listen, I need forgiveness. And I imagine what that conversation was. I imagine that Esau said, yeah, and I was bitter and angry, and I'm sorry for all that. But you go first. You go first. Don't go expecting them to go first. Number five, be patient. Be patient. Don't try to force reconciliation. You may not really be ready. They may not really be ready. Again, it was 20 years before this happened with them. Don't try to force it because it'll make it more complicated. Number six, have a willingness to address the issues in the other person, but do it with a heart of humility. In Matthew 18, 15, when it says, if a brother sins, go to him, the heart is to restore. It's always to restore. It's not to condemn. It's not to judge. It's not to write them off. It's not to make them pay. It's the heart is restoration, even when you have to bring up what they've done. And if you bring up what they've done and they don't hear it, then Scripture says bring 2 or 3 more. And if they don't hear it, bring it to the church or the leaders. Get someone to arbitrate and try to mediate. And if that doesn't work, then you may need to build in some boundaries if the person becomes toxic. And you may need to build boundaries for your own sake or your own family. But the heart is always restoration. And then lastly, and I think most importantly, forgiveness is absolutely essential. Forgiveness is absolutely essential. It's at the heart of the gospel message. We need to be forgiven for how we've offended. They need to be forgiven how they've offended. So first we ask for forgiveness. We don't demand forgiveness. We ask, we request, would you please forgive me? And then give them the freedom to say yes or no. But then we also are ready to forgive whatever way we've been offended. Because the heart of the gospel is that God has forgiven us. In fact, one of my favorite passages of scripture is Luke 7:47, which says, "He that's been forgiven much loves much." When I realize how sinful I am and I get forgiven by God, it makes me love him and love others. You want to grow in being more generous and loving others? Realize your need to be forgiven by God. And as you become more aware of how much he's forgiven you, you will love better. You will love him more, and you'll love other people more, and you'll be more quick to forgive others. Corrie Ten Boom, when she was asked, how could you forgive the Nazis for what they did to your father, killed your father, your sister, and what they did to you in those concentration camps? She said, I can forgive because I realize there's a Nazi inside of me. And when you've been forgiven for your sin, you're a whole lot more ready to forgive others. Let's pray. Father, what an incredible story, and I know we rushed through it, but there's so much in this story for us to unpack. And I pray that in the next couple days, you'll give all of us some time to think a little deeper about this story that we just looked at, and that you'll give us hearts that want to deal with what we're responsible for, and that we'll take initiative to go to people we've offended and ask for forgiveness, and we'll be ready to forgive those who've offended and hurt and wounded us. I pray for reconciliation. I pray for healing. I pray for restoration in broken family relationships, whether it's husband and wife or parents and children or siblings with each other. I pray for healing, and I pray that you would lead us to do whatever we can to move toward that. And God, I pray that you'd help us to be honest. That's where it starts, by being honest that we're a mess and so are others, and that's where you do your best work, in our honesty. So help us to be honest, even as we reflect a little bit more this morning, because we know whatever we're honest about, you have a solution for, and we need you.